U.S. law recognizes the importance of corals, and policymakers are asked to identify coral areas and take steps to protect them.
Greenpeace wants the federal government to take another look at Shell's Arctic drilling plans. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a remote control robot on the front lines of rural health care.
You know, they got that robot down to the clinic. I don't have to go to Goose Bay now. I can go and see the robot.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Environmental groups are asking the Interior Department to take a closer look at the abundant corals found on the Chukchi Sea floor. The soft pink coral is one of the most common species in the area where Shell is planning to begin exploratory drilling later this year. But Shell and the Interior Department say the coral has already been well documented and no further study is needed. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
At the end of July, Greenpeace marine biologist John Hosevar was on the organization's ship Esperanza in the Chukchi Sea. He wanted to survey the seafloor, so he got into a tiny red submarine and began descending into the icy water. In this audio recording, his passenger, Joe Lepore, describes what they see.
Bottom's in sight. On bottom. Okay, time 14:10. Pink object, bottom left of the screen.
That pink object Lepore talks about is soft coral. John Hosevar says biologists have described soft coral on the Chukchi Sea floor in the past, but he didn't expect it to be so prevalent.
We were surprised to see just how much there was.
The video shows the coral scattered along the soft seabed alongside sea cucumbers, basket stars, and thousands of brittle stars. Hosevar says the coral is an especially important species.
They are one of the few things that are sticking up off the bottom, so they're providing habitat and shelter for other species in the Arctic.
The Interior Department says it has already done extensive analysis of the Chukchi Sea floor and has considered the impact oil development could have on corals in the area. The department also notes the coral is known from previous research to be relatively resilient, but Greenpeace and the Center for Biological Diversity are asking the agency to conduct a supplemental review of the coral, given the amount their expedition uncovered on the Chukchi floor. Here's Hosevar again.
U.S. law recognizes the importance of corals, and policymakers are asked to identify coral areas and take steps to protect them. So, for the Interior to say, we knew there were corals there, we just decided that they weren't important, doesn't really hold water.
Shell says it has spent $60 million on baseline research in the Arctic, and the company has its own video of the Chukchi Sea floor from last August. It's very similar to the one Greenpeace produced this summer, and specifically points out soft coral. Shell spokesman Curtis Smith says decades of Arctic studies have documented the existence of this type of coral.
As part of our license to operate, and certainly the permits that we have, all of these things have to be taken into consideration, and of course the protection of these ecosystems and of course the habitats. So of course we believe, as the agencies do, that we have done that. Otherwise we wouldn't have the permits that we do.
Shell had hoped to be drilling in the Arctic by now. The company has more than 20 support vessels in place near both prospects in the Chukchi and Beaufort Sea, and 1,000 workers are standing by. But Shell's two drilling rigs are still in Dutch Harbor, and its oil containment barge, the Arctic Challenger, is undergoing some tweaking in Bellingham, Washington. Smith says he doesn't know when it will be ready to go, but the company will certainly be happy when it sets sail.
I would just characterize it as a strong desire, as you might imagine, to get to work. We've been planning this program for 6 years. We're now days away from drilling in the Beaufort and Chukchi Sea, so we can't rush through this last critical part.
Shell has to wait for the Coast Guard to approve the Arctic Challenger and for the Interior Department to issue its final go-ahead before it can begin drilling. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The State Division of Forestry is proposing the creation of a new state forest in the Susitna Valley, mostly on the west side of the Susitna River. State forestry officials outlined the idea at an informal presentation in Palmer. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer was there.
Only a handful of interested property owners attended the open house on the proposed state forest Wednesday evening. Most in the room at the State Division of Forestry building in Palmer were along for the two-day Board of Forestry meeting, and they represented local timber interests. Kenneth Bullman, Mat-Su area forester, said the formation of a Susitna State Forest is recommended in the Mat-Su area plan. Bullman said forming the state forest would provide economic incentive by ensuring timber harvest use into perpetuity.
When people come into the valley and they want to have some kind of economic growth or want to provide some kind of infrastructure, they can see, well, this land is dedicated and set aside. It's not going to be turned into settlement, or it's not going to be turned into agriculture. It's just dedicated strictly for forestry. So if we want to build some infrastructure and put some revenue into it, that it's not going to go away.
The state manages 9.5 million acres of forest in the Matanuska and Susitna valleys, and a little more than 2 million acres of that is managed for timber harvest. The Susitna State Forest would encompass 763,200 acres located in 14 management blocks. The land would be removed from land disposal for settlement, but would be open for multiple uses such as hunting, wildlife habitat, and recreation. The proposed forest would encompass land on the west side of Cook Inlet from Mount Susitna as far to the north as Petersville. Chris Mache, director of the Division of Forestry, said the idea is to look 25 years or more into the future.
Most places in the lower 48, if you like to hunt or recreate or do different things, it's often getting to be very difficult because there's not enough large blocks of public land left intact. And so that's one of the key things in my mind, is to preserve those opportunities for some of our future generations.
The proposed forest blocks are separated by state lands under Department of Fish and Game Management. Squintna resident Tom Payton, a longtime Alaskan, has a cabin in Squintna. Payton said he was not convinced the new state forest would benefit his area.
I have a lot of questions about it. If they can keep the smaller timber sales to be utilized by Alaskans and not try to ship timber or chip wood to Asia, and you know, then they'd have to develop large tracts of land for clear cutting, which would impact a lot of homesteaders, you know, in the Squintna area. So there's a lot of details need to be worked out.
Bullman said inholdings currently within the proposed forest boundaries would not be affected. He said other positive aspects of the plan include enhanced habitat for moose and the creation of roads into the forest for public use. Dane Crowley, a project manager for a pellet business in Fairbanks, said having a state forest near Matanuska-Susitna borough lands would benefit the borough economy.
I live here in the valley. We located that pellet facility in Fairbanks because of the Tanana Valley State Forest. I'd like to see one here. I've been involved in forestry and timber here in the Mat-Su for over 20 years, and there's a huge amount of potential here, but not a lot of focus on that. So I'm really, really pleased to see the division moving in this direction.
Last year, Senator Linda Menard attempted to get lawmakers' support for Susitna State Forest, but that move failed. According to Division of Forestry officials, there is currently no sponsor of a bill that would bring the plan to the state legislature next session. Bullman said that if legislation creating the forest is secured, a forest plan would have to be written within 3 years of the designation. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, composing classical music on the tundra.
A big blob of brass instruments playing something staccato, and then followed by percussion going boom, 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 boom.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable donations. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers home choice seminars that provide tools for making informed decisions about purchasing and financing a home and loans tailored for first-time home buyers. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Less than half of Alaska public schools made adequate yearly progress last year under the federal education law. The State Education Department says 236 of Alaska's 507 public schools met all their targets during the 2011 and 12 school year, or about 46%. The state next month will ask the federal government to approve new education standards to replace the so-called No Child Left Behind program. The state has requested a waiver from the federal law, which has vexed educators for a decade. Once the waiver is approved, Alaska will no longer have to meet AYP as defined by federal law. Eric Fry is a spokesman for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development.
If we're granted the waiver, this upcoming school year would be the last year in which we follow the AYP system. That would go away. And we'd have our own system, which would have to be approved by the federal government and follow some federal guidelines.
Under federal law, a school fails to meet adequate yearly progress if it falls short in just one category. Schools also are not recognized for annual improvements. State education officials are now in the process of adopting new assessments to replace adequate yearly progress. Fry says the accountability program would treat each school individually.
And one of the things that people didn't like about the law is that it seemed a draconian way of dealing with schools that might be doing rather well, but are falling short in just one or two areas. And so in the draft proposal that we've put together, all of that would go away, and instead we would ask schools to aim toward reducing their non-proficient students by half over a six-year period. So each school would have its own target based on where it's starting at now.
The lowest achieving schools in Alaska number about 60, Fry says. The State Education Department would step in to work with the districts to raise the achievement levels in each poorly performing school.
So at any given time, the state might be actively working with the districts on maybe the 50 or 60 lowest performing schools. Meanwhile, the districts wouldn't be off the hook for helping non-proficient students, but you wouldn't have this draconian system of consequences that are triggered by any little thing, and you wouldn't have the same consequences no matter what the real situation is on the ground. So we think of it as a more realistic system of accountability.
Before the U.S. Education Department will waive No Child Left Behind requirements, the state has to show that its standards in reading, language arts, and mathematics will prepare students for college and a career. The State Board of Education recently adopted the standards. Fry says the board believes they will be approved by the U.S. Education Department. The next evolution of telemedicine is employing robots. A project presented at last week's International Conference on Circumpolar Health in Fairbanks showed how a remote control robot is helping patients in the Canadian Arctic. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, Rosie the Robot offers a new option for medical care in isolated communities.
Rosie is named after the cartoon robot on the old Jetsons TV show.
Homely Buster, but I'm S-M-A-R-T smart.
The real-life medical robot Rosie is also pretty smart, but looks a lot different from the Jetsons mechanical maid.
It really looks like a big vacuum cleaner that is the size of a human, and it has a head that is basically a screen, a TV screen.
That's Ivar Mendez, chairman of the Brain Repair Center in Nova Scotia, which with several partners is piloting Rosie in Labrador. The $150,000 robot manufactured by California-based InTouch Health can listen to a patient's heart, perform ultrasound scans, and receive electrocardiogram signals, as well as do other assessments. Doctors like Mendez use video game-style controllers to move Rosie and her tool attachments to interact with patients.
For example, it can go to the emergency room and can participate in a resuscitation of an individual. And the doctor that is manipulating Rosie can actually direct nurses or other personnel to do life-saving procedures. And these things are very hard to do or impossible with static regular telemedicine stations.
For the past year, Rosie has been deployed at a clinic in Nain, Labrador, a place where villagers contend with bad weather and high cost to fly out to see doctors. Another Rosie Project team member, former Inuit government health official Gail Turner, says locals have taken to the robot.
First, obviously, it was like, what is that? And even for me, I couldn't get my head around what this robot would do. But once I actually saw what the robot could do, I was totally sold. They're saying, oh, my God, this is some good. You know, they got that robot down to the clinic. I don't have to go to Goose Bay now. I can go and see the robot. And for them, it's a huge issue.
Turner says Rosie also plays an important role in training and supporting nurses and interns, making them more likely to stay on in the remote community. Dr. Jay Butler, Senior Director for Community Health Services with the Alaska Native Health Consortium, says the state has long been a leader in telemedicine, and robots like Rosie have potential here. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Inupiaq and Yupik actress Irene Bedard, best known as the voice of Pocahontas in Disney's animated classic series, is returning to Anchorage, where she grew up, and launching a film production company. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
The name of the company is Sleeping Lady Films Waking Giant Productions. It's based on the legend linked to Mount Susitna across Cook Inlet from Anchorage about a giant woman who will awaken when the world is at peace. Bedard says that fits with the company's focus.
It's a production company that focuses on inspiring stories that feature Native characters, Native themes, Native stories that are inspiring Alaska stories, and it's something just, I think, to be proud to say that we're here in Alaska.
Bedard says the company will also help round out the image of Alaska.
We are excited to have, you know, the shows like Deadliest Catch and the Alaska State Troopers, and I, you know, I'm very have been very proud to see those shows. But I think that there's so much more to show, and to be able to go out to the rural Alaska areas is something that we're excited about doing.
Bedard says she's also excited to help build the growing film industry in Alaska.
We have people who work in the production office. We have people who work behind the camera, and we have people who work in front of the camera. So all of those facets of working in the industry are need to be utilized while we're up here, especially if we're going to have more than one show running at the same time simultaneously. So that is something that we are hoping to be able to do. It's called Action. And we're hoping to be able to bring up some industry professionals and do some training programs.
The company has a couple of projects underway, one involving Maori people of New Zealand, another a Christmas story told through live action and animation. The company's CEO, Tom Denumi, says they're also pitching a series called Reservations Not Required for distribution on public television.
It's a cooking show, and it features a chef, Freddie Bitsui, who is Navajo and classically trained as a cordon bleu chef. But he also has a background in cultural anthropology. So what he does is he travels to reserves and reservations throughout North America, and he rediscovers what really is indigenous foods. And so it's a cultural show, it's a cooking show, and it's a travel show all wrapped up in one.
Bedard was nominated for a Golden Globe Award for her breakthrough role as Mary Crow Dog in the 1994 television movie Lakota Woman, Siege at Wounded Knee. She's also known for roles in the feature film Smoke Signals and the PBS American Experience series We Shall Remain. In Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by
Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
Berries and trash are blamed for bears that have approached hikers on the Granite Tourist Trail near Fairbanks. The popular 15-mile loop in Chena River State Recreation Area has been the location of four human-bear run-ins this summer, including an incident this past weekend in which a black bear ripped a hole in a tent. The other three involved a pair of young grizzly siblings. No people or bears have been injured, but the encounters have been intense enough that bear spray, rocks, and guns have been used to scare the animals away. Chena River State Recreation Area Chief Ranger Ian Thomas suspects two primary factors may be triggering the bear trouble.
Simply, the bears are in the area because of the good berry crop this year, and they're staying in the area partially because of that and partially because they're habituated to human smells and food. Some of the often used sites along that trail are polluted with food smells and trash.
The Granite Tourist Trail has been closed since Sunday following the latest bear-human encounter. Thomas says it's unclear how much longer the trail will be closed. Park rangers were sent out Friday to look for and potentially shoot the grizzly pair that's harassed hikers. The animals were not seen, and then the black bear incident happened. Thomas says rangers will continue to patrol the trail, but they're not set on killing bears. The U.S. Forest Service is asking for the public's help in solving the mystery of the stolen cedar planks. In March, the Forest Service and Juneau Snowmobile Club stashed five caches of rough-cut yellow cedar along Douglas Island's Dan Moeller Trail. The lumber was to be used for a plank replacement project starting this month. But when the crews went to retrieve the wood, Forest Service Recreation Program Manager Ed Grossman says planks had been stolen from three of the five caches.
It was special order product out of Icy Straits lumber, expensive, naturally rot-resistant, and not easy to replace. And we're just saddened by it because it's obvious what it was for.
Grossman says about a dozen planks are missing, each one about 12 feet long and weighing between 40 and 70 pounds. The stolen lumber has an estimated value of $527. Grossman says part of the plank replacement project will be delayed until next summer, and he says instead of using snowmobiles to transport the materials, the Forest Service is likely to commission a helicopter, which is more expensive. America's national parks serve as a backdrop for some of the United States' best-known artwork. Much of that work was created long before the National Park Service established an artist-in-residence program. One man has just completed his fourth residency in Alaska and his ninth in the United States. KUAC's Emily Schwing caught up with Stephen Lias in Bettles to find out how he turns a backpacking trip on the Arctic tundra into a classical music composition.
More than 80 years ago, composer Ferdinand Groffet wrote the Grand Canyon Suite. The third movement is arguably Groffet's most famous. It's his interpretation of a donkey trotting through the Arizona desert. Dale Lane Gardner is the coordinator of the Artist in Residence program at Gates of the Arctic National Park and Preserve, north of the Arctic Circle. She says Groffet's work is the precursor to a now vibrant and growing program.
Early artists are some of the reasons why the parks were created. Some of the paintings done of Yellowstone and Yosemite that were brought into people's lives who never would have visited these places. And it inspired this awe in people that just telling them about a place doesn't do.
Not every national park in the United States has an annual artist in residence. But of the 23 national parks in Alaska, composer Stephen Lias has done a residency program at four, including Denali, Glacier Bay, and Wrangell St. Elias. He just returned from a 10-day patrol with a park ranger in Gates of the Arctic.
Each park presents its own experience, but this one was by far the most immersive. It was the longest. It was the one that pushed my boundaries the furthest.
This summer, the Fairbanks Summer Arts Festival showcased a composition Lias created after his experience in Denali in 2011. The National Park Service also hosted a concert inside the Denali Park boundary to show off Lias's work. Lias says he tries to avoid expectations prior to his residencies, but when he landed in Bettles in late July and started planning his adventure in Gates of the Arctic, he did have one specific goal in mind.
To migrate with the caribou, and so they had done some advance reconnaissance with aircraft, and we were getting reports from other rangers and scientists who had been in the field and saw overall probably almost 1,000 caribou in the last 10 days.
But Lias is quick to point out that what his music evokes is somewhat intangible. You may not, for example, hear the musical version of a caribou.
It's more likely to be, what did it feel like to look at the caribou, rather than what does a caribou sound like? Although I will say that as I listened to the sounds, certainly there are some very musical sounds out there. The wolves howling, the sound of a loon.
He uses writing and photography in the field to keep track of his feelings and his senses.
I stand on the tundra and I photograph, because visual images capture so much of the experience and it's easy to retrieve later. Sometimes I'm journaling, you know, what my thought process is. Sometimes it's simply what we did today. Other times it's little sketches of musical melodies or just shapes on a page of, I want a big blob of brass instruments playing something staccato and then followed by percussion going boom, 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 boom. And I'll just, you know, just scribble things on the page to try and capture those ideas so I don't lose them.
When he returns, it's not with sheet music. That comes after he's had time to sort through his photos and flip through the pages of his journals.
Since I'm a classical composer, it's not the sort of thing you can do easily in a tent. So I usually do the composing afterwards. But I come back from the residency with lots of really solid ideas, many of which end up in the piece itself.
Lias has completed residencies in 5 other national parks, including Rocky Mountain in Colorado and Big Bend in Texas. All of the music Stephen Lias composes will be compiled to mark the centennial celebration of the National Park Service in 2016. In Bettles, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Palmer, Rosemary Alexander and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Emily Schwing in Bettles. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Fall semester is just around the corner. Alaska Pacific University offers 2-year, 4-year, master and doctorate level programs committed to student-centered experiential learning. And there's no application deadline. Online education options are available in all undergraduate programs. For more information on how to obtain a quality and affordable education, visit alaskapacific.edu or call 564-8248. This message sponsored by APU. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at alaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.